Welcome to Cybersecurity Where You Are, the Center for Internet Security's podcast. I'm Sean Atkinson, CISO at CIS.
And I'm Tony Sager, Senior Vice President and Chief Evangelist at CIS. Cybersecurity affects us all, whether we're online at home, managing a company, supporting clients, or running a state or local government.
So join us on Wednesdays as we discuss trends and threats, explore security best practices, and interview experts in the industry.
Together, we'll clarify these issues, creating confidence in the connected world.
Hello, and welcome to the show, Cybersecurity Where You Are. I'm Sean Atkinson, CISO here at the Center for Internet Security, joined by the host with the most, the difference maker and the Hall of Famer, Mr. Tony Sager. How are you, Tony?
Great. Thank you, Sean. It's great to be back on with you.
Fantastic. Great to see you. And we're joined by a very special guest, Dr. Tyler Moore, the Tandy Endowed Chair in Cybersecurity and Information Assurance, Professor of Computer Science, Chair of Cyber Studies at the University of Tulsa. Dr. Moore, great to have you with us.
Great to be here.
Fantastic. So I'll just jump in with an introduction, a little bit of a fanboy of the work you've done with security economics, thinking about assessing necessarily security from an economics decision-making perspective, trying to assess and quantify that risk so it's tangible for many different audiences, and that we can actually get to a point of both measurability and responsibility in this space. So we can start to, I'll use the air quotes for those watching the video, the problem of cybersecurity and where we currently exist in the risk dynamic today. So a big fan. I think your work is transformative and just really honored to have you as part of the show. But I'd like to start off, if it's okay, with just if you could give us an overview of the economics of cybersecurity and some of those principles of economics that intersect with cybersecurity.
Sure, I'd be happy to. So this whole economic perspective coming to cybersecurity really started about 25 years ago, in the early 2000 timeframe. And up to that point, cybersecurity was thought of as a primarily technical endeavor. But what was realized is that it turns out that if you just think about it from a technical perspective, we didn't do a very good job of anticipating what our adversaries were doing, didn't do a very good job of explaining what companies and defenders were doing about the decisions they were making in terms of what to protect and how to what not to protect. And so economics comes in and it can really help sort of at the most fundamental level by introducing this notion of incentives, and the incentives of participants really drives outcomes. So it's the incentives of attackers, how they choose their targets. It's the incentives of defenders in deciding what they are going to protect versus what they're not. And from there, the other big organizing principle is this concept of market failures. And so cybersecurity, for those who've been around long enough, we know that we're spending more on security, we're putting more efforts in, and yet the outcomes don't look that different today as they did before. If anything, things are only getting worse. And so why is that? Well, economics offers some answer in the form of market failures. The two big ones are information asymmetries, which mean that it can be hard to for two parties to a transaction to know what the other know what the other has. And so there's an information asymmetry about this, the security of software, of the security of all kinds of products. And that makes it harder to choose those products and which ones are better. There's also externalities where typically harms, bad things, insecurity, that consequence falls on third parties, not the individuals, organizations making the decisions. And so these starting concepts really kind of help explain the challenges of security and ultimately point to what needs to be done in order to actually make improvements in security going forward.
Wonderful. Wonderful. And again, just to, and Tony, I aligned to 25 years ago with CIS and us developing the concepts necessarily in the space. But Tony, I'll go back to some of the thoughts that, you know, we've solved cybersecurity 40 years ago. We've just not implemented it yet necessarily. what are your thoughts?
Well, I think there's some really important themes here. And by the way, Tyler, one of these days I've been giving some thought to, just as a complete branch off to the tree here. There was a period of time, I don't know if you know this, my first career was 35 years at the National Security Agency as a cyber defender inside an intelligence agency. So I had a pretty unique view of the world. But there was kind of a period from the very late 90s for about a decade where just tremendous number of shaping activities happened, you know, from the interaction with the public, the really explosion of the internet as a commercial and social activity, and so forth. So, you know, it's interesting to talk about 25 years ago, because it kind of lines up with where a lot of things that I was seeing. But, you know, what we were discussing before you came on, so I was there, not part of it, but in the mid-80s was kind of the high point of some of the smartest minds on earth thinking about computer security. And you're right. They took a nod at economics, but they completely missed the boat. But it was, again, really smart people thinking about the machinery of computing, how to manage data, how to separate it, how to set policies and enforce them through technology. And it was a tremendously interesting time. Again, I was on the analytic part of NSA, sort of watching that shape up. So it was evaluating was the term we called it, the concepts. And the concepts are sound, and some of them are built into computing as we know it today. But, you know, and people would say, well, in the mid-80s, we solved the password problem in the mid-80s, you know, with the A1 evaluated, formally verified, blah, blah, blah. And in some sense, they were true, right? They were correct. But, you know, what was created didn't run PowerPoint or could not be connected to an untrusted network without completely undoing the security model. And so what was really missed was this explosion in connectivity, but also the sort of real life things that people do with computers. And so, you know, the notion was the government will invent it and people will then behave that way. When in fact, that we saw the shift in commodity computing became the driver for the industry, right? You know, again, I got into this because of Apple II pluses and IBM PCs and Commodore 64s. But those requirements became the driver, and no one had any patience for waiting for this problem to be solved. So I think, you know, you're on a really important theme here, but it was people thought about it, but not really deeply, I would say, and not with a kind of practical, you know, application around this notion of a market failure. So I think you're absolutely right on that.
So one point to build on what you're saying there is, you know, there's a difference between an existence of a technology that will solve a problem and its wide scale adoption out in the world. Right. And so that's the other piece of it. So it's not just, we didn't anticipate that the internet was going to emerge. It's also just because you had a technology that may have solved this password problem. If nobody's going to adopt it, then what does it matter? Is sort of the right. the economic response. Yeah.
Yeah. And similarly, one of the things I say in talks is often something, around this, the best technical answer has never won on its own, you know, because of the decision making, right? Because of the risks that you talked about, that, and this the notion of information symmetry is absolutely right. You know, that is the complexity, the fuzzy language, you know, the changes in technology. People can't make rational risk decisions because they don't have the information that would allow them to do so. But let me kind of take you down one thread of thought that we've been discussing at CIS, that, you know, there's been kind of a notion, right, that if we just shared enough information, the verb that we all worship in the DC area is share. If we all just shared information about incidents and what happened to us with everybody, then everyone would get really smart and they would know how to defend themselves. And it took me years to figure out that has never actually worked. And so because of the complexity, the number, the dynamics and all that. And I said, what's been missing, the verb that matters in security is not share, it's translate. How do I translate millions of data points of badness into a small number of positive, constructive things you can do about millions of things? Or, and then this is, I think, the key, the way that we think of things like public policy for public health, transportation and so forth, right? We don't ask people to become experts. We translate science into behaviors. And these are the behaviors that we encourage or discourage based upon you know, and the assumption we assume as citizens, smart people at the FAA are thinking about, you know, aircraft construction. Smart people here over here are thinking about bridge construction. Is that kind of the model that we're headed towards? Is that a useful way to encapsulate some of this complexity into decision making?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a good start for sure. Whenever I, you know, hear about information sharing, which I advocate for in many, many cases.
I understand.
Yeah.
I don't mean to be a curmudgeon.
So my version of the curmudgeon response to information sharing is it's absolutely necessary, but not sufficient to solve our problems, right? So, you know, let's say we somehow get the best possible information sharing. I think it could really help eliminate many of the information asymmetries that are present. You could really solve that issue, but that's going to do nothing for dealing with misaligned incentives when they exist, and for nothing for externalities. So basically, you still have to consider that people are going to make decisions in their own interests, and organizations are, and having all the information in the world about it isn't going to always be the solution. Now, it can solve a lot, and I think, you know, that's why it's good for public policymakers to focus on information sharing as an achievable sort of next step goal, but it's definitely not the end all.
Exactly. Well, I think in some cases, Tony, with Dr. Moore, you know, under CIS, the banner is the Multi-State Information Sharing and Analysis Center, as well as the election infrastructure. And having those elements, I think, has helped, not solved, but I think it's helped solved necessarily an ability to address the problem, I think, more succinctly. And Tony, you know, as we go into the vastness of data, the frameworks and things, I owe you money. You know this with the commentary of the fog of Moore. And then obviously I have to say it because of obviously Dr. Moore's last name.
But it's trademarked, right? Fog.
Exactly. But we have this... I mean, in some cases, sharing is good, but the velocity, the veracity of what is being shared is also, it needs to be consumed. And I think that translation piece is very important because it needs to necessarily be brought to us in a form or format that makes sense. And really what aligned me to your work, Dr. Moore, was the translation necessarily of return of security investment and those types of elements that are translatable for financially driven minds from C-suites and things of that nature that helps that translation. I think that's so important to be able to conceptualize that it helps with the measurement. Then it also helps distinguish responsibility and in some cases prioritization. It helps us then now assess our current posture, what type of resources, and gets to really that economics of decision-making, as it were, having that palatable to a number of different audiences versus it being strictly technical or just a threat intelligence type report is not necessarily, it's not bad, but it's not necessarily going to get us to any greater levels of security without a lot of action.
Yeah, absolutely. So was there a question there?
Well, no, because the reason for that is when we look at these decision-making elements is, well, what do we see as being most pressing? So, you know, we've got all of this information. We've got an ability to share. We can do big data analytics. We've got AI and capability. But still, we see that there are, one, economic issues that necessarily hit cybersecurity, but then also a reflection that we've got cybersecurity problems that can't address economic issues. And so it's, you know, battling between one another.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so I think there's two things. I mean, one, going back to your point about translation, right? You know, I think that is absolutely key. You know, I think one of the things I teach my students is to calculate security metrics. One is return on security investment. You know, there, you know, the whole strategy is, you know, you need to meet the C-suite where they are. And so it's absolutely a CISO is going to have to go in and educate the board and the C-suite on what the, you know, some of the technical details of the threats that are present. But at the same time, when it comes to prioritizing decision making, you know, we have pretty good language and sort of with ROI calculations with these metrics. And we've essentially, you can take sort of knowledge of sort of the probability of attacks occurring and what the rough costs are, and translate that into these ROI metrics and things. And I think, you know, what we've seen is if you go to the trouble to do that, you know, you now we're speaking a language that enables you know, the very smart people in the C-suite to actually reason with you, and so that I think is a certainly a good step. Now it's imperfect, and that's one of the challenges, is that, you know, just because I can create an ROSI metric, it's often based on data that is far from ideal, right? Because you're having to, you need to know how likely an attack is to take place, what it's going to cost, and what your defensive countermeasure is going to reduce those probabilities and possibly the costs. And so those are all very hard things to measure. And they're unfortunately not routinely measured and tracked today in our industry, right? And so, you know, I'll be honest, if you're going to be someone who goes down this path and tries to quantify these risks, you know, you're kind of swimming upstream in a lot of ways, because the security industry is not going to be terribly interested into subjecting their tools and technologies to independent evaluation to be able to determine how effective it is. They're not going to be transparent about, unfortunately, about the occurrence of certain incidents. Firms who get attacked don't want to talk about how much it costs them. And so, you know, that to me is the big challenge. All, you know, actually applying this model in an environment where you have imperfect information is an ongoing challenge. But I think it's one that it still is a useful framework for how to make decisions. And you can still make progress as soon as you get comfortable with the fact that it's not going to be, you know, 100% accurate all the time.
Yeah. It strikes me that, you know, it's an area. I've often said that perfection has been the enemy of the good enough in cyber for most of our time here, because of the high technology and the uniqueness of the language. That, you know, there's a way you make a living. I call it the security Jedi mind trick. You know, whatever you're doing, that's very clever, but I know five more scenarios that will undo that, and that might technically be true, but is it actionable? Does it make sense? Is it high enough probability? Is it, you know, and so if you try to design against everything, then you wind up paralyzed and designing against nothing. And so we're with you. It's, there's sort of a, but where is the level of confidence, right? How do we get enough? And I would agree with you that we have more data. Speaking as an old guy in the business, we're back in the day, right? Anything sort of specific was in the double top secret, only, you know, anointed government people and their friends will know. And I look at today's world and go, oh my God, we're drowning in data. Yeah. Now the problem is inconsistent, you know, noisy, uncertain quality. There's lots of challenges with that, but we actually know more about bad guy tradecraft, right, in a very public way than we ever have had, you know, in the history of this industry. And so if we can't work with that, then, you know, shame on us. But I think some of it is this, you know, how do we have enough confidence to have and have a model, which we agree is imperfect, but is still useful, right? Is directionally consistent, I think is really an important part of that.
Yeah, I think, you know, what I see in some of my own research and elsewhere is that in a world where you have imperfect data sources, you know, triangulation is a very useful method where you can essentially collect data, disparate data sources to study the same problem from different angles. And if you end up with roughly similar recommendations and conclusions, then you know you're probably on the right track. So we use that a lot. You know, we had a series of papers over the years looking at how do you measure the cost of cybercrime, right? This is an area where, you know, there's this, I don't know, game theory where everyone just wants to make up bigger and bigger numbers, right? And so now, like, the cost of cybercrime is, like, I don't know, tens of trillions of dollars per year. And yet, every time you look at those reports, there is no methodology. It's pulled from the air.
We agree 100%. Yeah. And it's hard to take action based upon, you know, and I watched them, right? Estimates of $1.98 or $3 billion.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. we're
struggling here, but
somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah, but I think where things, you're right that you shouldn't let perfect be the enemy of the good. But the question is, how can we make progress and actually have some confidence in quantifying risks and costs and this kind of thing. And, you know, I think the key is to make the problems tractable. You know, I'll give you a counterexample, which is all these reports about the costs of cybercrime. You know, so, you know, you read a report, everyone's bigger than the last. They're always outdoing themselves. It's $5, $10, $20 trillion of cybercrime losses per year. And you look behind the curtain, there's almost no rigor to their methodology, even if there is one. And so I would say that trying to get a dollar figure for what the cost of cybercrime is asking the wrong question. And we've done a lot of research in this space where we try to sort of decompose the different types of cybercrime and what their costs are, right? And so, you know, it's phishing, it's malware, it's you know, advanced fee fraud scams, it's, you know, intellectual property theft. All these different things come together and they each have their own confidence bounds of like what we know in terms of available data and what we know about what the risks are, right? And so what you can say is we can't actually say all of this adds up to a certain dollar amount, because if you did, the confidence interval would be too huge. But instead, if you say, I'm only interested in this particular threat of cybercrime, this particular cybercrime type, then you can actually reason a bit more about what the true costs are. And so it really is beneficial to get specific about the threat that you're studying. And that's where I find, you know, things work best.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's right. Sort of narrowing. I don't know if you follow our work, Tyler, but the one of the things we have tried to do. So we're responsible, among other things, for creating security guidance. You know, and think of that translation, right? We look at all this threat stuff, and we, you know, work with close to 20,000 state and local governments. We see this, and to translate that into action, these are the things that you ought to do. But what we've tried to do over the last couple of years is work this from the other side of the equation, which is, can we, for any recommendation, how do those recommendations get made? Rooms full of clever people argue until they get tired of each other, and then they write it down. And that's the unspoken secret of this industry here, right? Everyone brings experience. Everyone brings judgment. This is all good to capture it, but it's not very satisfying in terms of rigor and repeatability. So what we have done is work with the major threat intelligence folks like the Verizon data breach people and folks like that to identify the top handful classes of problems that everyone should worry about, whether you know it or not. You should worry about these classes of problems because they have big impact. We use some formality, a model, and if you're familiar with the MITRE ATT&CK framework, and we use that as a rigorous way to describe those classes of problems and allow us to break them down into their sort of atomic elements. And then we look at every recommendation and say, what value does this recommendation give you against some part of this description of these top five classes of attacks? And the idea there is to try and bring some rigor to this recommendation. If it has no value, if you can't, is it just a good thing to do just in case someday maybe, or is there some value against a specific step or stage or element of an attack? That's so we built a model around that, put it in the public, and that allows us then to, again, it's imperfect in the same way we talked about other things, but it's the most rigorous way we know of given the data we have and so forth. And the idea then is allow us to make a statement about value for individual things. And the goal is to, it's my premise, and I would appreciate your opinion, is if those of us that make recommendations had more rigor, transparency behind it, that would allow from the other end more opportunities to kind of match, modeling and numbers and, you know, techniques like minimization, right? I want to get a certain effect with my defenses, but I don't want to over defend. I don't want to have too many layers. I don't want to spend more than I need to. Does that make sense conceptually? Is that helpful?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think hearing you describe it, what my first thought is, by being sort of structured and rigorous in your thinking about here are the threats, here are how we think these controls theoretically should mitigate these threats by following, you know, stopping this point in the kill chain or whatever. That's all good. The nice thing about it is it actually creates the opportunity, if you wanted to validate that with collecting data, it becomes more a matter of, okay, here here is the, you may know about the kinds of data you could collect that could validate those recommendations. Whereas if you, it was just a smoke filled room where you came out with your list of 20 controls, you'd almost not know where to begin in terms of collecting data. So I think the advantage of being structured is it does create, number one, you know, theoretical models do matter, right? Especially in when you're avoiding data. I mean, I'm primarily an empiricist, so I often let the data guide decisions, but there is an absolutely a role for theory here. And I would say what you've described is essentially theoretical foundations for why you'd expect the mechanism to work it the way it does. And so that is a reasonable approach. But it also sets up the potential for validation with data.
Your point is that having a model now directs your gathering is a really critical one, right? It says that, you know, you use kind of what you have, and you have this mishmash of data from Verizon and Palo Alto and CrowdStrike and all these great companies. Now, this is why when I first looked at this when I retired in 2012, you know, again, I came from a closed community where you had, oh, it's double top secret, and you have insight that's not generally available public. Then I get outside of the walls there, past the concertina wire, and I go, what have I got to work with? Wow, look at all this mountains of stuff that's actually out there being given away as marketing materials. We got to be able to do something with it. But I think your point is, again, some structure allows us then to make that value judgment of this type of attack in general has more impact than others, and I want to collect more information about it, but I need a way to kind of narrow the thinking. And I think that I hadn't thought of it that way, but I think that's a really healthy way to bring those two together.
Absolutely. And, yeah. You know, on whenever we were trying to measure empirically the cost of cybercrime, we started with a very simple model as well of like sort of decomposing the different components of the costs of direct costs, indirect costs, the infrastructure costs, and these kinds of things. And then that set out when we were reviewing, again, the public information on attacks for different crime types, we said, oh, well, we have data here, here, and here, so that's our estimate. We don't know anything about this category, so it's sort of an unknown, but we've now named the unknown, and we sort of narrowed the scope of where the lack of information is.
Yeah, I think one of the ways I've thought about this is that, you know, so if you take the smoky room model that you had, right, that's sort of a pure judgment model. I'm counting on these smart people to cooperate enough and to bring enough experience to the table that's something good. But you don't know where, you know, you have no ability to reason or dispute or add to that judgment call. So when I think of modeling, I think of it as we're not trying to eliminate human judgment. We're trying to put bounds around it so that we kind of know where there's rigor and we know when humans need, you know, can make a value judgment or bring their sort of, you know, experience to the table, not easily quantified. And that's a clear place for discussion. And we could say, I can get better information. I could collect more to help fill that gap. And I think that's consistent with what you described, right? The structure allows us to understand, because we're not going to eliminate. In fact, we want to take advantage of the great experience and good judgment of people who have looked at this a lot. At the same time, we can't leave it as a black hole in a smoky room. It doesn't allow us to build public policy and so forth.
Exactly. Well, I think it's an element of repeatability, because we've got to continuously do this, because necessarily yesterday's threat environment is completely different from today's, and we've got to assess those risks consistently by utilizing necessarily a repeatable process. So you're not going to get those people in a room again and have the exact same discussion, because ultimately over time that the experience changes, the landscape changes, and the input changes, therefore the output, and it's a completely different set of requirements, recommendations from kind of that gut instinct necessarily, or that experience. Yeah.
So, Tyler, I don't know if you know this, but Sean is actually the CISO of the Center for Internet Security. And, you know, we're a modern computing organization, right, with a worldwide footprint and you know, lots of complicated partnerships and data. So Sean's the guy that speaks to the board, that, you know, that manages, puts together risk. I call him the speaker to boards. And maybe you guys could talk a little bit about that, because you're, you know, the role of quantification and economics. And so we have a fussy board, right? Because they're all security professionals. And, you know, our entire reputation is based upon security. So maybe we can go down that route a little bit. What do you think of the the role of the board. What you know, you talked earlier about sort of what, how do they make decisions, but how does a Sean present that in a way that resonates with them?
So, I mean, Sean sounds like he has an even harder task because he's got all the fun of a board plus all the sort of all of the overconfident knowledge of the security people. So it's
beautifully said.
Yeah. But, you know, for the mere mortals who only have to talk to normal boards, I think, you know, most boards, I mean, they're very comfortable managing enterprise risks and business risks, right? And so that is where an effective CISO is going to approach how they talk to the board and try to get through to them, is to understand, you know, from their perspective, most boards are members are going to view cybersecurity as just another risk that the organization faces. And that's absolutely the right way to view things, right? And so to the extent that you can frame cybersecurity risks as a general firm risk, that's all the better. That's why in the metrics we emphasize all right, return on security investment, why we try to quantify things, because it lends itself, once you've turned the risks into a quantifiable number or dollar, then it's naturally comparable to the other risks in the organization. So the other thing I would say is that while technical cybersecurity people maybe can poke holes in your data modeling and this sort of thing and can be paralyzed by the sort of imperfection of the data available, boards are generally comfortable with that, right? Because they know all data is bad everywhere, right? It's not like we're unique in that respect. So I think, you know, that's a good starting point. And then from there, you just need to be prepared with the data you're using to be able to defend it and talk about its limitations, right? So you go in sort of with awareness of saying, this is what the data tells us. But, you know, if we're wrong in this way, there's sort of our decision can be bounded by this much in this much direction. So embrace the uncertainty and, you know, translate the risk into a general business risk.
Absolutely.
Sean, does that sound like your day?
Sounds like the battle scars that I have. No, you're absolutely right. I mean, that's where obviously I found your work and was when I was going through and calculating ROSI and looking at, you know, the FAIR models. And even, Tony, I'll, you know, represent SIRA, the Society of Information Risk Analysts, and their quantitative approach that is very insightful, especially, you know, some of the work from this year's conference that you were at. There's so much input now. And I think we're, you know, getting into that stage and there's topics here to talk about cyber insurance and actuarial approaches to thinking about necessarily the quantification. I think that's a whole nother episode, but is
bring me back. I have lots to say.
fantastic. We certainly will.
On it.
But it brings us to this point of, and I think that's what you hit upon, Tony, was translation, right? It is taking this, being able to translate between the board necessarily, and then also bringing that board perspective back to the organization. And in some cases, I think there's I think there's also shared responsibility in this case. And one of the things, Tyler, that I've been thinking about is the responsibility of boards to get up to speed necessarily with understanding cybersecurity. You know, digitization of the business processes is, you know, what are we, 20, 30 plus years in. It's now time that cybersecurity is not a technology risk. It is inherent to the business operation. And so I think there's reflection there that there's an element that they also educate themselves to a point where translation is not as important, but it's not essential. You know, I shouldn't have to necessarily break everything down into the base level in terms of being able to represent this risk as a true business risk and not something that's, you know, a parenthetic of technology.
Yeah, absolutely.
And with that, we'll be right back after this quick break.
Most organizations want to streamline their cybersecurity and compliance efforts.
It's just not always easy to do so on your own.
That's where a CIS Secure Suite membership can help. It provides benefits, tools, and resources designed to help you implement the CIS critical security controls and CIS benchmarks. Secure Suite can help you strengthen your cyber defenses, comply with common standards, and cybersecurity frameworks, all while saving you time, money, and effort. Apply for membership today by visiting cisecurity.org. Start secure and stay secure with CIS Secure Suite.
Thank you, and let's jump back into the episode. So, Tyler, is there anything you would leave our audience with, the big message, the big idea that you've seen, obviously, through your research, what you've provided the community, what you continue to teach and lecture the lucky students at the University of Tulsa? Any thoughts there?
Yeah, what I would say is, especially for the practitioners out there, don't be afraid to try risk quantification, you know? And it doesn't have to be overly complicated. There are different approaches. You mentioned, you know, Sierra and FAIR. Those are, you know, there's a lot going for them. But, you know, very base level sort of calculations are worth considering even as a thought exercise. So, I mean, I'll give you a story. I don't know if it's the best thing to end on, but, you know, security people are notorious for maybe over suggesting controls without thinking about what the costs are, right?
Shocker.
Yeah. So maybe this is near and dear to my heart because it happened this week. We got a new printer in the office, right? And it has a security feature, which is a nice one, which, you know, there's a security risk. You print the sensitive document, you retrieve it, but you forget about it. Somebody else gets it to it before you. So we now have a new printer, which you will print a document, goes out to the printer, but nothing happens. You have to wait until you go physically to the printer, you badge in, hit like four buttons, and then it will actually print the thing off. Maybe you already got it. We've got it now in Tulsa. And, you know, that is definitely more secure in protecting the privacy of the printouts. But, you know, it also incurs a very constant cost. Every time someone has to go stand to the printer, you're spending, you know, 60 to 90 seconds of your day every time you want to print something off, more than you would have to retrieve it, right? And so there's a natural cost benefit right there, right? So is the benefit is quite clear with the security benefit you get, but the cost is substantial and incremental, right? And so what I would, you know, encourage those working in cybersecurity to do is every time you're considering a new security control, a new intervention, just think a little bit about the benefit you're seeing and can you quantify it? Maybe you can, maybe you can't. And then the costs that it might impose, right? Which can be opportunity costs and, you know, time wasted. It can be money out the door. And so quantification can be that simple, right? And so you sort of weigh things from there and decide to go forward. If you can bring that perspective and mindset to your operations, then you're already well on your way to improving cybersecurity more than we are doing today.
Oh, that's very well stated. And, you know, we looked at, when I started to really get involved in this as I retired, I said, you know, if you make security, and you gave an example, right, too onerous or too expensive, your users now become your attackers. So we're all old enough to remember when Dropbox became a verb and thumb drive became a verb, right? You put incredible controls on your perimeter and people Dropbox around you or thumb drive around you. And my experience has been, it's not because they're evil. It's because they have a job to do. And, you know, and they need to move large files from, you know, here to the photo processing organization or to a contractor or whatever. And you either, as a security person, either help them do that in a way that we can all live with, or you now encourage them to attack you, you know, with, and you saw this like in the NIST guidance around passwords, right? If you make password policy too complex, well, you encourage the worst kind of behavior, reuse, you know, one up your passwords, write them down on the sticky note, all that kind of stuff. So that's the real life thing that's been missing for most of our history. I think you're right on the money there, which is there's 1,000 good things to do, but without context, they're just things to do that add cost and so and complexity, et cetera, et cetera. So we're very good stuff. All right, Sean, I don't know what you think, but I think we have a lot more to talk about with Dr. Boer. And so,
absolutely. I think
we are very interested in this, as you can probably tell. We spent a lot of time at CIS in the last 2 or 3 years thinking about things like establishing the value of controls, influencing public policy, the sort of incentives and all that. And so there's a lot more that we'll have to have you back to talk
about. Well, I mean, I'd love to talk more about that, and also even offline separate to this podcast, if you want to brainstorm how to do that, I would love to work together with you on that, because I mean, obviously the CIS controls are very, very influential, and you know, any way in which we can make them more, you know, make the whole process more evidence-based and effective, I'd be happy to shout my ideas at you.
Perfect. So thank you to Sean for being the fanboy that brought you to our podcast here for a great discussion, and look forward to the next one, both on screen and then not on screen.
Sounds good. Exactly. Have a good day, guys.
Thank you. You too. And thank you to our audience. Really appreciate it. Make sure to subscribe in all the usual ways. Catch us on YouTube at The CI Security. And with that, we'll talk to you soon.
Thank you for listening to the podcast today.
The thoughts and opinions expressed by our podcast guests are solely theirs and do not necessarily reflect those of CIS.
Tune in on Wednesdays for a new episode. And in the meantime, visit our website at cisecurity.org.
Together, we'll continue our efforts of creating confidence in the connected world.